At the Gold Strike Saloon, sunbars slanted in through the doors and windows, highlighting the thousands of dust motes that hung in each beam of light. It was too early in the morning for customers, but that didn't mean that the saloon was empty. Paul, the bartender, was washing and polishing glasses. The handyman, Jesus Rodriguez, was working with a mop and bucket, making passes across the floor. Of all the women who worked at the saloon, Minnie was the only one up at this hour, and she was sitting at a table near the piano, having her breakfast of biscuit and coffee. It wasn't required that she be here yet. None of the girls were required to be at work before noon, but Minnie thought she'd rather be here than alone in her room worrying about Bobby Lee and Smoke Jensen, wondering where they were at this exact moment. Doc Baker came into the saloon then, smiling and waving a copy of the Cloverdale News leaf.
Wait till you read this.
Neighbors got up and stepped over to the table where Minnie was sitting.
What is it?
Read it, and then we'll talk about it.
Do you mind if I read it over your shoulder, Nate?
Don't mind at all.
Knowing how much Marvin Cutler wanted to see Bobby Lee hang, it must have killed his soul to write this.
What makes you think Marvin wanted to see Bobby Lee hang?
Why do you even have to ask? You read that article he wrote about Bobby Lee? What was it he said in the last paragraph? Oh, yeah, I remember. A great crowd present to witness Cabot being delivered into the hands of Satan will send a signal to all who would contemplate duplicating Cabot's foul deed.
Marvin Cutler is the consummate newspaper man. He is sometimes prone to be a bit overblown with his stories.
A bit overblown? He is a pompous blowhard.
Daring jailbreak. On the 28th instant, desperado Bobby Lee Cabot effected a daring escape from the jail at Cloverdale. The jailbreak came 3 days before Cabot was scheduled to be hanged by the neck, the gallows having already been built and prominently displayed on Fremont Street in front of the jail. The jailbreak occurred at 5 minutes after 11 p.m. of the clock. There could be no doubt of the time, as it is firmly fixed in the minds of the citizens of Cloverdale who heard the sound of the detonating dynamite, which explosion rent an opening in the back wall. Deputy Beard, who was the only eyewitness, states that he saw naught but the backside of Cabot as he made his egress through the aforementioned hole. Beard discharged his pistol at the escaping prisoner, but the errant ball struck the wall with no effect. It is not known who helped the outlaw escape, but it is known that a telegram was dispatched on Cabot's behalf to Buck West, though no one seems to have noticed when or if the man Buck West ever actually arrived in town. Sheriff Wallace harbors the suspicion that West is the one who enabled Cabot to thwart justice. Bobby Lee Cabot was, at the time of the commission of the crime, a railroad detective for Western Capital Security Agency. It was the contention of the prosecutor and the conclusion of the jury that Cabot took advantage of his position to gather information as to times and routes of trains and stagecoaches, upon which large amounts of money would be transferred. Because the Western Capital Security Agency is well aware of its obligations to protect its clients, the WCSA has put up a reward of $5,000 for the capture of their erstwhile agent.
You know what I think?
What do you think?
I think Wallace might have been involved with the train robbery that they got Bobby Lee on.
I'd be quiet about making that accusation, Doc. Wallace doesn't strike me as the kind of man who would take too kindly to it.
But don't you think he might be?
I have certainly thought about it. But let's say you're right. What can we do about it? Where will we go with our suspicion? To the sheriff?
Right.
As the two men were discussing the subject, neighbors started to fold the paper closed to return it to Doc Baker. But just as he did, Minnie saw an article that caught her attention.
No, wait.
You can have the paper if you want it, but that is the only article about the jailbreak.
I saw something else I wanted to read.
One article in particular had caught her attention.
Two new riverboats purchased. News from St. Louis is that on Friday last, the purchase of two new steamboats was announced by Thaddeus Culpepper. The boats, modern in every detail, will be floating hotels on the Mississippi River, and none who ply that waterway for trade or pleasure will enjoy more accommodations or luxurious staterooms. They will enter service from St. Louis to New Orleans with immediate effect. The boats will be named Christina Dawn and Minnie Kay.
You planning on taking a boat down the Mississippi River, are you?
Why not? I read that article. Those boats sound like they would be something just real grand. But I know what caught her attention. One of the boats is named after her.
What? Let me see. Ah, the Minnie Kay. It's not named after her. Minnie's middle name is Lou, isn't it?
Yes, Minnie Lou Smith. But it would be nice if I could make that claim. I'm sure those boats are just really grand.
The little sign had been professionally lettered, and it stood proudly just outside the town. Midas, population 213. No one is a stranger. It was Thursday, August 30th, when Smoke and Bobby Lee arrived in Midas. It was a community where false-fronted shanties and canvas tents competed with each other for space along the length of a single street.
You ever been here before? The reason I asked is there anyone here who might recognize you?
I was here once, but that was a couple of years ago, and I didn't stick around long. I doubt anyone would recognize me.
Despite the remoteness of the town, it seemed to be quite busy as vehicles of commerce rolled up and down the street. In addition, there were two new buildings under construction.
I'll give the town this. It sure is a busy little place.
Yeah, it is at that.
Smoke pointed to one of the more substantial buildings, which had its name, the Silver King, painted in red on the top of the false front.
What do you say we stop here?
Now that's the best idea you've had since the one you had about putting dynamite behind the jail. But my ears are still ringing.
I could have left you there.
No. Don't get me wrong. Believe me, I'm not complaining.
The two tied off their horses, then stepped inside. If, as the sign outside town stated, there were 213 residents, Smoke figured that at least 10% of them were in the saloon, even though it was just mid-afternoon.
Yes, sir, what can I serve you?
How's your beer?
Wet.
Sounds good enough. This looks like a pretty lively town.
It is. There was silver discovered 3 years ago, and that's what caused the town to come here in the first place. That played out and looked like the town might die. Then some fellas come across a new load no more than a month ago, and we've had some new folks come in. Yeah, but I have to tell you, you boys don't look like no miners.
I'm looking for someone.
Who would that be?
Frank Dodd.
I reckon that might be who it was. Him being an outlaw and wanted and all.
Have you ever seen him?
He's been through here a time or two. We don't ever stay long, though. You after that reward, are you?
Yeah. Do you think the sheriff might have any information on Dodd?
He might.
Where will I find him?
His office and the jail are at the far end of the street on the other side. You can't miss it. There are about six tents, then one brick building, and that's the jail.
Thanks. I believe I'll step down and pay him a visit.
Smoke waited until the bartender moved away. Then he spoke to Bobby Lee.
I'm going over to the sheriff's office to see if he has anything about your escape yet. That'll let us know how careful we have to be while we're in town. You stay here.
Smoke, I was in jail, so I don't have any,
I got it.
Smoke took a $20 gold double eagle from his pocket and gave it to Bobby Lee.
Don't spend it all in one place.
Thanks.
It was early afternoon and quiet in the Gold Strike Saloon. Nate Neighbors was sitting at the piano. Paul was behind the bar polishing glasses. Doc Baker and Byron Hughes were engaged in their eternal game of chess, sitting near the piano enjoying the music. And Minnie was reading the newspaper.
Where is she?
Looking up from the paper toward the batwing doors, Minnie saw Sheriff Wallace standing there.
Ah, there you are.
Shh! Sheriff! Enjoy the music.
I don't want to enjoy the music.
Well, maybe some of the rest of us do.
What are you doing here? Why aren't you out looking for your escape prisoner?
I am looking for him. And you are going to help me find him.
Me? How am I going to help?
I want to talk to you.
All right, Sheriff, have a seat. You won't even have to buy me a drink.
No, not here. Down at the jail.
What?
What's going on here, Sheriff? Are you arresting Minnie?
Not now, but if she won't come down willingly, I'll arrest her.
On what charge?
For interfering with an investigation. And if any of you give me any more of your lip, I'll arrest you too.
Now, my damn, you just hold on there, Sheriff. You can't just...
Never mind. I'll come.
I thought you might. Let's go.
When they reached the jailhouse, Minnie noticed that the door was open between the front of the building and the cell area. Glancing through the door, she saw a bricklayer hard at work repairing the hole.
Have a seat, Miss Smith, is it?
Yes.
Is that your real name? I know that most of the time whores take on phony names because they don't want their families finding out anything about them.
You know all about whores, don't you?
I know considerable about whores. I'm a lawman. I have dealt with them quite a bit. Of course, I don't blame whores for changing their name. I don't reckon anyone who would whore has any pride left. But don't you think you could have come up with a better name than Smith? That's not what you would call just real original now, is it?
Why do you need to know my real name?
Because I'm going to ask you some questions, and I'm going to have to know whether or not I can believe your answers. Now, if I can't believe your real name, how am I going to believe you?
Minnie didn't answer.
Well, what is it?
Minnie Smith is my real name.
All right, Miss Smith. I have a few questions for you.
Minnie said nothing.
Why didn't you tell me that Buck West answered your telegram?
He didn't answer my telegram.
Don't be coy with me, Miss Smith. I don't mean that he answered your telegram with one of his own. I mean that he came to Cloverdale.
He didn't come to Cloverdale.
Don't lie to me. He damn sure did come here, and you know it.
Wallace pointed through the open door to the hole in the back wall.
Who'd you think did that, if not Buck West?
I don't know.
Somebody did it, because the blast came from outside the jail. That means somebody helped Cabot escape.
Minnie said nothing.
You and Cabot were friends, weren't you?
I'm friends with a lot of men. You said it yourself, Sheriff. I'm a whore. I am paid to be friends.
But you were sort of a special friend to Cabot, weren't you?
Sheriff, could you come back here a moment?
I'll be right there. You stay right here.
I'm not going anywhere.
Minnie glanced at the open drawer and saw something. There in the sheriff's drawer was a letter from Bobby Lee. The mailing and return address on the envelope clearly legible. As the sheriff and the bricklayer carried on their conversation in the back, Minnie thought of the letter that was in his desk drawer. Dare she to open it? Getting up from her chair, Minnie moved to the back door to listen to the conversation between the sheriff and the bricklayer. The sheriff was asking about something, and the bricklayer was trying to explain it. It sounded involved enough to give her the opportunity she needed, so she returned to the desk where the drawer was still open. Then, with another look back, she reached in and removed the envelope. Opening it, she pulled out the letter and began to read.
Dear Sheriff Wallace, I take pen in hand to inform you of a planned holdup of the Nevada Central train to be perpetrated by Frank Dodd and his gang. As we discussed, I have joined with Frank Dodd and his brigands in order to get the information we need to effect his arrest. The planned robbery will take place on Tuesday next, August 21st, at the evening hour of 10:30 at the Water and Tower 10 miles south of Lone City. I'll be riding a gray, the only rider so mounted. Please have deputies on hand in the express car so that we may apprehend Dodd and his men. Sincerely, Bobby Lee Cabot.
So the sheriff had lied during Bobby Lee's trial. He had received the letter. She knew it. Oh, why hadn't the judge let her testify?
Whatever you're gonna do, do it. Don't take all day to do it.
Minnie's heart leapt to her throat, and with nervous hands, she replaced the letter in the envelope, then put it back in the drawer. But her hand was still in the drawer when Sheriff Wallace came back into the room.
What are you doing in my desk drawer?
Seeing a pencil and a blank piece of paper, Minnie pulled them both from the drawer.
I was going to leave you a note telling you that I was going back to the gold strike.
You ain't going anywhere until I tell you that you can. Just put the pencil and paper back in the drawer.
All right. It doesn't matter now anyway. You're back.
Now, I'm going to ask you one more time. And if I find out you are lying, I'll send you to prison for helping Cabot escape. Women don't do well in prison.
I haven't lied to you, Sheriff.
Did you send a telegram to Buck West?
Yes.
Did he reply to the telegram?
No. And if you knew I sent it, then you also know that he didn't reply. I'm sure you checked with the telegrapher.
Did you meet Buck West?
No.
Look here, Miss Smith. Are you telling me that Buck West did not come to Cloverdale in answer to your telegram?
I'm telling you there was no Buck West.
Do you know the penalty for lying during an official investigation?
Yes, I do. Do you?
What is that supposed to mean?
You said you didn't get a letter from Bobby Lee. I know that you did.
How do you know?
Minnie caught herself. She had almost given away the fact that she had seen the letter in his desk. If he knew that, all he'd have to do is destroy it.
I know it because Bobby Lee told me he mailed it to you.
No, all you know is that he told you that. That didn't work for Cabot during the trial, and it isn't going to work now. Get out of here, Miss Smith. I don't have any more questions for you.
That works out fine then, doesn't it, Sheriff? Because I don't have any more answers for you.
If you hear from him, Miss Smith, I'll know about it. Whether it's a letter or a telegraph message, I will know about it. So I'm telling you right now, if you do hear from him, you had better let me know right away.
Doc Baker was gone by the time Minnie returned to the Gold Strike Saloon.
Minnie, thank God you're all right. Doc and I were worried about you.
Where's Doc?
One of the workers down at the mine was hurt. Doc went to tend to him.
Nate, I saw the letter.
The letter?
The letter Bobby Lee had me send. I saw it. It was in the middle drawer of the sheriff's desk. I read it too, and it's exactly the way Bobby Lee told us. The letter tells what day, what time, and where the train was to be robbed. And in the letter, he asked the sheriff to be waiting in the express car with his deputies.
Lord, Minnie, you weren't prowling around in Wallace's desk, were you? What if he'd caught you?
I wasn't exactly prowling. The sheriff got called away for a moment, and he left the middle drawer of his desk open. I saw the letter in the drawer, so while he was gone, I read it.
I knew he was lying. He stood right up there in court under oath and swore that he had never received that letter. I knew then he was lying.
What do we do with it now?
Do with it, Minnie? You didn't take it from his desk, did you?
No. I thought about it, but what good would that have done? That wouldn't prove that he'd ever gotten it.
You're right. Oh, this is frustrating. We know for sure that he got the letter, but how are we going to prove it?
We've got to arrange for someone else to see the letter. Someone the judge will trust. But I don't have any idea who that might be.
I have an idea who it could be.
Who?
Marvin Cutler.
The newspaper editor? Are you serious? You read his articles. He's had it in for Bobby Lee.
No, he doesn't. Not really. Like I said before, he's just a newspaper man. And the very fact that his previous story seemed to be against Bobby Lee would just make him that much more credible. Yes, sir, if we can arrange for Marvin to see that letter, there is no doubt in my mind but that the judge will listen to him and believe him.
If there really was a letter, then yes, I would do the story. As a member of the noble profession of the press, it is my duty to see that the truth is told and justice prevails.
You aren't running for office, Marvin. All we want to know is, will you do the story?
Yes, it would be a great story, Doc. And it might give me the opportunity to undo what damage I may have done by being so quick to judge.
Good. Then all we have to do is give you the letter.
No. I can't take the letter from you.
Why not? How else are you going to write about it if you don't see the letter?
I have to see the letter in the sheriff's possession. Otherwise, there would be no proof that it wasn't a plant.
Are you accusing us of trying to plant evidence?
Heavens no, my dear fellow. I'm merely saying that, for the integrity of the story, I must personally see that letter in the sheriff's hands.
How are you going to do that?
Did you say you saw it in the middle drawer of the desk?
Yes.
Then somehow I'm going to have to get it from his desk.
Do you have any idea how you're going to do that?
Well, nothing comes to mind.
Perhaps we can arrange a diversion. Something that will pull the sheriff and his deputies away from the jail.
Yes, that would be a very good idea.
You go on back to your office. Let the three of us put our heads together. I'm sure we will come up with something.
Very well. Get word to me when you have an idea.
Mr. Cutler?
Yes?
Where did you get that story about the two new river boats in St. Louis?
What story is that, my dear?
The newspaper was still lying on the table, and Minnie showed him the story.
Oh, my dear, disabuse yourself of any idea that because we are in a remote part of the United States, that we are unable to report on the latest news from anywhere in the world. I'll have you know that this newspaper is a member in good standing of the Associated Press, and because of that, we receive news articles such as the one you mentioned on a daily basis.
I see.
Why the particular interest in that article?
One of the boats is named after her.
Indeed?
Not exactly, but close enough that it got my attention.
Well, I'm glad you enjoyed the story. I pay a fortune for the service, and one never knows if the stories I print from the Associated Press are even noticed by readers. I'm pleased to see that they are.
Now all we have to do is come up with a diversion of some sort.
Neighbors and Doc Baker began discussing ideas as to how to get the sheriff and all his deputies away from the jail, but Minnie wasn't listening. Minnie had drifted off to another time and another place. She was remembering St. Louis 2 years ago. Minnie's mother had died when she was 18. 3 months later, her father shocked all of St. Louis society when he married a young girl who was not only the same age as Minnie, but who had been one of Minnie's high school classmates. She had graduated with Minnie. The graduation taking place just 1 month before she married Minnie's father. The person everyone in Cloverdale knew as Minnie Lou Smith was not, as so many of the soiled doves, a young woman driven to the profession by a state of destitution. On the contrary, the young woman everyone knew as Minnie Lou Smith had come from one of the most affluent backgrounds in America. Her real name was Minnie Kay Culpepper, and her father, Thaddeus Culpepper, was owner of the Culpepper Riverboat Company. Thaddeus Culpepper was a millionaire many times over.
Minnie, I would like for you to meet your new mother.
Standing beside Thaddeus was Christina Dawn Turner. Christina Dawn and Minnie Kay had known each other for many years and had long been adversaries, sometimes rivals for the attention of a young man, other times competitors in academic or athletic projects. Until the moment of her father's announcement, she had no idea that there was any kind of relationship between Christina and her father. Her mother had only been dead for 3 months. How long had this relationship been going on? How could her father marry this person?
Christina is not my mother.
I am now.
Minnie was shocked that her father had so dishonored her mother, and she wondered how he could have so betrayed her. There was no doubt in Minnie's mind but that Christina had married her father for his money. In fact, Christina didn't even deny it when Minnie made that accusation.
Tell your father that and see which one of us he believes.
Minnie did indeed make such an accusation to her father.
Be gone with you, girl! She's my wife, and more than that, she is your stepmother. You will honor her as you honored your own mother, and I will not listen to any more scurrilous accusations.
But father, you must listen to me. This marriage isn't right.
Minnie! If you cannot find it in your heart to accept this young woman who I love as a part of this family, then I will have no choice but to expel you from the family.
Minnie had no idea that her father would ever consider such a thing. Then, the longer Minnie thought about it, the more determined she was to deny him the opportunity to ever expel her from the family. She decided to expel herself. A week after that conversation, Minnie left home, taking a night train out of St. Louis. She had no particular destination in mind, but after a series of train rides, she stopped when the last train she boarded reached the end of the track in Cloverdale, Nevada. She had met Janet Farrell on that trip down from Battle Mountain, and Janet introduced her to Nate Neighbors and the life, as Janet called it. She lost her virginity the first night she went to work, but given everything else that had happened to her, that was almost insignificant. She had not been in touch with her father in the 2 years since she left St. Louis. She had no wish to be in touch with him now either, because she did not want to give Christina the satisfaction in knowing that she had become a whore.
I got it.
You've got what?
Haven't you been paying attention, Minnie? I got the solution to our problem. I know what kind of diversion to create in order to get the sheriff and his deputies away from the jail.
Although Minnie wouldn't admit it, she had been so lost in her memories that she had not been paying attention. She had to regather her thoughts to know what he was even talking about.
What's the idea?
There needs to be a fight And it can't just be any fight. It has to be a fight that'll get the whole town to come watch.
Who are you going to get to fight that would draw the entire town to watch? Hell, Nate, you know as well as I do that drunks get into fights every day without anyone paying the least bit of attention.
Yes, but this won't be just a couple of drunks. And I guarantee you that folks will come watch these two fight.
All right. Now you have me interested. Who is going to fight?
Minnie and Janet.
What? Are you crazy? Janet is my best friend. I'm not going to fight her.
I agree with Minnie. You can't ask her to pick a fight with Janet.
It wouldn't be a real fight. All it has to do is look like a real fight. And it has to take place outside so the whole damn town can come see it.
I don't know. What do you think, Minnie? Would you go along with something like that? And do you think Janet would?
Janet would if I asked her to. Especially now after Sheriff Wallace killed Andy.
Do you think you two could make it look real? I mean, real enough that the men who gather to watch it will be convinced that you two are actually fighting.
Yes, women have been putting on shows for men since the dawn of time. I don't think we'll have any problem in convincing them that it's real.
Will you arrange it with Janet?
I'd be glad to.
Half an hour later, Minnie and Janet walked across the street to the Cloverdale Emporium. They found a hat that was the only one of its kind in the store, and both of them reached for it.
I saw it first.
No, I saw it first.
I did.
Minnie pushed Janet down and picked up the hat from the floor. Janet jumped right back up, then pushed Minnie outside, where the fight continued until they were standing in the street. Though it looked like they were very angry and doing their best to hurt each other, the pulling of the hair was actually very controlled. As neighbor predicted, though, the fight began to draw a crowd until soon, well over 100 people, almost every one of them men, were gathered in the middle of the street.
What the hell?
Sheriff Wallace came storming down the street. Marvin Cutler was standing just behind the corner of the leather goods store, watching. As soon as Wallace started down the street toward the fight, he moved quickly to the front of the jail. He went into the sheriff's office, pulled open the middle drawer of the sheriff's desk. Then he saw the envelope.
I'll be damned.
Cutler picked up the envelope. Then he removed the letter and began to read. That evening, Marvin Cutler worked late in his newspaper office, writing the story even as he was setting the type. So familiar was he with setting type that he was able to read and proof the story, even though every letter and every word was backward. When he finished setting the type, he perused it once more, and then with a smile of satisfaction, he put the plating in place and printed the first issue. It was the first extra issue he had ever put out.
Extra, extra, extra. A reconsideration of the trial of Bobby Lee Cabot, along with every other good citizen of the fair city of Cloverdale. This reporter sat in the court trial of Bobby Lee Cabot and not only watched, but celebrated the fact that Mr. Cabot was found guilty of the murder of August Fletcher. August Fletcher was, at the time of his tragic demise, a messenger for the Western Capital Security Agency. This fine gentleman, a husband and father, was performing his duty aboard the Nevada Central train when on the night of 21st of August, the train was robbed and he was killed. The Cloverdale Newsleaf printed an article condemning Bobby Lee Cabot while praising the justice done in finding him guilty and sentencing him to death by hanging. But recent evidence has come to light which convinces me that justice was not done. On the contrary, an innocent man has been found guilty, and he has been found guilty not because of a failure in the judicial system, but because of the perjury of one man, a man who, while purporting to be a servant of the people, has in fact engaged in perfidious conduct that knows no bounds. That man is Sheriff Herman Wallace. Those who followed the trial may remember that Mr. Cabot tried, on repeated occasions, to introduce into evidence the fact that he had sent a letter to Sheriff Wallace previous to the robbery, in which he had disclosed all the information necessary to bring about the arrest of Frank Dodd and his gang. Sheriff Wallace claimed that there was no such letter, and indeed, without that letter in evidence, Cabot's defense was ineffective. The Cloverdale Newsleaf can now report that such a letter does, and in fact did, exist. It was, even at the time of the trial, in the sheriff's desk, and, Had Mr. Cabot been fortunate enough to have been assigned a competent attorney, a simple warrant and search would have disclosed that fact. This newspaper found the letter in the sheriff's desk, not by writ of warrant, as would be required of an officer of the court, but in the exercise of the freedom of the press. That letter, now in possession of the Cloverdale News Leaf, is included herein for the perusal of all justice-minded citizens.
Dear Sheriff Wallace, I take pen in hand to inform you of a planned holdup of the Nevada Central train to be perpetrated by Frank Dodd and his gang. As we discussed, I have joined with Frank Dodd and his brigands in order to get the information we need to effect his arrest. The planned robbery will take place on Tuesday next, August 21st, at the evening hour of 10:30 at the Watering Tower, 10 miles south of Lone City. I will be riding a gray, the only rider so mounted. Please have deputies on hand in the express car so that we may apprehend Dodd and his men. Sincerely, Bobby Lee Cabot.
It is the sincere hope of this newspaper that Judge Briggs will declare the first trial to be a mistrial and will, by judicial fiat, overrun the verdict of the jury. It is the further hope of the newspaper that Sheriff Wallace will be arrested, removed from his high office, tried, convicted, and punished, not only for the perjury which condemned an innocent man, but for what may well have been his own complicity with Frank Dodd.
Cutler blew the ink dry on the single-sided, single-sheet extra edition newspaper, then smiled. He'd been in the newspaper business for over 20 years, and this would be the biggest story of his life.
Sheriff, have you seen this?
Deputy Beard stepped into the sheriff's office carrying an edition of the extra Cutler had put out.
No, what is it?
Though the expression on Beard's face was one of great concern, he said nothing as he handed the paper over.
I never read the newspaper, it's just a waste of time. If anything happens, people start talking about it anyway.
Well, you better read this one, and this ain't something we want people talking about.
All right, hand it over.
Wallace began to read, at first with bored indifference, though that quickly changed to anger and concern.
What?
Putting the paper down, he jerked open the middle drawer of his desk.
Where's that letter?
According to the article, Cutler took it.
Why, that son of a bitch!
I told you, you should have got rid of that letter.
I think I need to pay Mr. Cutler a visit.
I don't think you want to do that.
What do you mean?
Take a look down the street towards the newspaper office. There must be 20 or 30 men gathered there. They're talking about forming a citizens' committee to put you under arrest.
Me? Don't you mean us?
Yeah, I mean us.
Damn!
What are we going to do, Sheriff?
I don't know what you're gonna do, but I'm gonna find Dodd, get my share of the money, then get out of here. I'll go to Arizona or California or some such place.
I'm coming with you!
Smoke Jensen and Bobby Lee Cabot, unaware of the newspaper article that could clear Bobby Lee, had been on the trail now for just over a week. Needing to replenish their supplies, they stopped in the town of Lunning in front of Grove's General Store, then tied their horses off at the hitching rail. Then they stepped up onto the porch. That was when Bobby Lee saw the poster.
Hey, Smoke, take a look at this.
He pointed to the wanted Dodger that was nailed to a post.
Wanted. Dead or alive. Bobby Lee Cabot. Buck West. $5,000 reward. It's been a long time since there was a reward out for Buck West.
At least they don't have pictures or descriptions, and they don't have you connected to it.
Not yet, anyway.
When they stepped into the store, it was redolent with the familiar smells of cured ham and bacon, dried jerky, flour, spices, apples, onions, and tobacco. Smoke bought jerky, bacon, dried beans, flour, and tobacco.
Hope nobody finds you.
I beg your pardon?
Boys, you don't have to be coy with me. I've been in this business a long time. I can tell by what you're buying, what you're up to. You found a promising strike somewhere, and you want to work it alone until it's developed. Like I say, I hope nobody finds you.
Oh, well, you're right. You startled me. I didn't think it was that obvious.
Oh, you can't fool an old man like me. I hope you have an authentic strike, but I have to warn you, I spent 20 years poking around up there in the Takima Range, where I found a lot of places that looked promising, but I never found anything that paid out. Well, that's why I gave it up, come down here and run this store. It started out just by working here, but I saved my money and I bought it from the man that owned it first.
Yeah, sounds like a smart thing to do. You would be Mr. Groves, would you?
No, sir. My name is Wagner. I kept the name Groves because that's the name of the fella who owned the store first, and, well, that's how folks remembered it. Plus which, I wound up marrying Mr. Groves' daughter, and keeping the same name of the store helps keep the peace in the family.
I notice you have three saloons in town. Which one is the most popular?
The New York saloon is the best. It's always filled with people.
What about the other two? The Lucky Chance and the Lost Mine?
The Lucky Chance isn't bad, but the Lost Mine... I had never been in it, but from what I hear... There don't nobody but the dregs of the county ever go in there. They say it ain't nowhere near as nice as the New York.
Thanks for the tip.
Once outside, Smoke tied the sack to the saddle horn, then untied the horse and swung into the saddle.
What do you say we get us a beer?
Sounds good to me. The New York?
Not yet.
Not yet?
You check out the Last Chance. Have a beer. Keep your eyes open and see what you hear. I'll do the same thing at the Lost Mine. We'll meet in the New York in about an hour and compare notes.
All right.
15 miles southwest of Lunning, in the small town of Marietta, Emmett Clark was having his lunch in the Silver Palace Cafe. Dodd and Conklin were over at the Hog's Head Saloon. Since joining Dodd, Clark had been involved in four more robberies, two additional stagecoaches, one freight office, and a grocery store. The shotgun guard riding on the second stage had tried to defend the coach against the robbers, and Clark had shot and killed him. In Clark's mind, his descent into hell was complete. No longer did he try to maintain the fiction of being drawn onto the outlaw trail by events beyond his control. He now considered himself to be a man without conscience or honor, and he was not in the least disturbed by that. Finished with his supper, Clark began perusing the newspaper. Queen Victoria, now 60 years old, had worn the crown of England for 42 years, a longer period than that known to any other living European monarch. Clark wondered what it would be like to be a monarch for 42 years, maybe not as good as it sounded. The next article also caught his attention.
Mr. Thomas Edison, the inventor, has been exhibiting in New York his improvement of Mr. Alexander Graham Bell's telephone. Mr. Edison's instrument is said to be of such power that the receiver need not be placed at the ear in order to catch the sound. He also says that he has nearly perfected his new electric light. Claims that he has supplied 6 lights from 1 horsepower and that the cost of the light is not more than 1/3 that of gas. Mr. Edison has stated that it will soon be time to let the public realize the benefit of these marvelous inventions.
Clark had never seen a telephone, but he had heard of it. He knew that a telephone was something like a telegraph, only you could actually speak through the wires, though he had no idea in hell how that would work. He was about to lay the paper aside when he saw an article that began with the headline,
Record Money Shipment.
He read the article with a great deal of interest. Folding the paper over, Clark left his meal half-eaten and hurried over to the saloon. Conklin was sitting alone at a table in the back, eating cracklings and drinking beer.
Where's Dodd?
He took a whore upstairs.
What room?
How the hell do I know what room? Could be any of them. Far as I know, every room up there is a whore's room.
He needs to see this.
What is it?
Like I said, it's something Dodd needs to see.
I wouldn't go up there if I was you. I've known Dodd a long time. He don't like being bothered none when he's with his whores.
He'll like this.
Less than 1 hour after Clark showed the newspaper article to Frank Dodd, Herman Wallace rode into Marietta.
What makes you think Dodd will be here?
He told me he would be. He always kept me posted as to where he would be. How else do you think I got information to him?
What's he going to think now that you have no information to give him?
I don't care what he thinks. The son of a bitch owes me money, and we're gonna need money to get out of here.
Where do we look first?
Where do you think?
Wallace turned his horse toward the Hog's Head Saloon. Having heard nothing of particular interest while spending time in the Lost Mine Saloon, Smoke moved from the Lost Mine to the New York Saloon. The New York Saloon was considerably larger than the Lost Mine and much more crowded. It took Smoke a few seconds to locate Bobby Lee, who was sitting alone at a table in the middle of the crowded room. He crossed over to join Bobby Lee at his table.
Anything?
Nothing. How about you?
I overheard something about a story in the newspaper. A train carrying a lot of money.
Smoke went over to a bar and bought a newspaper. Coming back, he sat down and read the article about the shipment of $100,000.
The money's being shipped from Carson City to Columbus. How far is that?
It's just under 150 miles.
Do you know the route?
Not really, but back in our Reno office, we have a map of every railroad in Nevada. I just remember seeing it.
Bobby Lee looked back at the paper, then noticed another article of interest.
Hey, Smoke, look at this. Here's a reprint of an article from the Cloverdale News Leaf. I think I've been cleared.
Smoke read Cutler's article, then nodded.
I think you have too. So, what do you want to do? You want to go back to Cloverdale?
No, not yet. This may be the best opportunity we will ever have to get Dodd. I started out to get him, and I intend to do just that.
What was that date again?
The 3rd of September. Wait a minute. That's tonight.
Yes. What do you say we walk over to the depot and get a map and a schedule?
Good idea.
5 minutes later, the two men were at the Lunning Depot, perusing the train schedule and studying the railroad map.
You know how Dodd works. Do you have any ideas how he'll plan to do it?
From the look of this map, I say he'll try it at Hawthorne.
Hawthorne?
Yeah, look here. It's 45 miles from Cleaver to Hawthorne, with no water tanks in between. 45 miles is just about the limit an engine can go without refilling its tank. So the train is going to be awfully thirsty when it gets there. And because it will come through at 11 p.m., most of the town will be asleep. Dodd will wait until the train stops, then he'll hit it.
That sounds reasonable. How far is Hawthorne from here?
25 miles, according to the map.
If we want to be there by 11, we had best be going. I hear the train. Get ready.
Smoke and Bobby Lee were behind the feed and seed store in Hawthorne. That was directly across the tracks from the water tower. They were on the same side of the track as the door to the express car. That way, they'd be able to observe any approach to the car.
I haven't seen anything of you.
No, I haven't.
I know they're here, though. They have to be here. There's no other place where they will have the train stop like this.
The train approached the water tower, its speed already greatly reduced.
We'd better get mounted. We may have to move fast.
Smoke and Bobby Lee swung into their saddles as the train rumbled by, then came to a complete halt. The fireman came out of the engine cab, climbed up on top of the tender, brought the great water spout down to the tank opening, then pulled on the rope to lift the gate and start the flow of water.
See anything?
No. How far to the next water tank?
It's all the way back in London. Damn. If they're waiting there while we came up here, I'm gonna feel pretty foolish. I'm sorry, Smoke. Looks like I led you on a wild goose chase.
Oh, don't worry about it, Bobby Lee. We'll just do what has to be done.
What'd that be? If Dodd is waiting in London, well, there's no way we can get there in time to stop him. The train will run 25 to 30 miles per hour. Well, we would kill the horses trying to keep up that pace.
We aren't going to try and keep up with the train.
We've lost the opportunity, though, haven't we?
No. The train hasn't been robbed yet, has it?
No. If it had been, the express man would have made a report as soon as the train arrived. Nobody came out of the express car.
Then it isn't too late to prevent the robbery.
How?
Simple. We just ride on the train. I'll get us a couple of tickets.
What about our horses? There's no stock car on this train.
We'll board them here, then take the next train back.
Bobby Lee took care of boarding the horses while Smoke bought tickets. The train was already rolling out of the station when the two men ran down the platform and leaped up onto the rear mounting step of the last car.
Where should we go?
If we can find a seat in this car, this is where we should be. That way, if Dodd does try anything, he'll be in front of us.
Oh, good idea.
Bobby saw a couple of seats halfway up the car on the left-hand side.
How about if we sit there?
Good choice.
Do you really intend to wreck the train?
Emmett Clark spoke after Dodd explained his plan to the others.
Yes?
Why? All you have to do is wait by a water tower. You know the train's going to stop there.
This train is carrying $100,000. That means it is going to be full of guards, all of them riding the express car, and every one of them will be expecting us to hit the train at one of the watering stops. They won't be expecting us to wreck the train, and chances are that after we wreck it, they won't be in any condition to stop us.
You mean they might be killed in the train wreck?
Yeah. I wrecked my share of trains and killed my share of people during the war. What's different about this one?
Well, there are innocent people on this train.
There were innocent people on other trains I wrecked, too. Do you have a problem with that?
I don't have any problem with it.
Wallace, Beard, and Conklin had joined up with Dodd on the same day Clark took him the newspaper article about the money shipment.
I need money if I'm going to get a new start somewhere, and I don't care what I have to do to get it.
Look, Clark, if you don't want to be a part of this, you can ride out now.
What's the breakdown again?
There are six of us. You will each get $15,000, and I will get $25,000.
I don't like that.
Then ride out now. That'll be just more money for the rest of us.
I didn't say I wasn't going to do it. I just said I didn't like it.
All right. Let's stop worrying about who might get hurt. Ain't nobody ever going to get out of life alive anyhow.
Dodd, I hear a train coming.
All right. The palavering is over now. Get back, all of you.
As the others got back out of sight, Dodd bent down over the detonator generator. A wire from the generator ran to the sticks of dynamite that had been carefully placed on a wooden trestle that spanned a gully 40 feet deep and 150 feet long. Clark watched as the train approached the trestle. He had an inclination to suggest that Dodd blow the bridge now, for doing so would prevent the train from going any farther and might spare the lives of the passengers. But he said nothing, because he knew that Dodd was right. With a shipment of money as large as this train was carrying, it would be heavily guarded. And simply stopping that train would not be enough. They would have to deal with the guards, too. Clark drew a deep breath, then let it out slowly. His share would be $15,000. He concentrated on that amount. $15,000. As the train approached the trestle, Clark thought he had never seen anything so beautiful in his life. It was like a painting. The engine headlamps stabbing forward, the boiler shimmering in the moonlight. Some of the car windows were glowing, but most were dark. By the orange light of the cab, Clark could see the engineer leaning out the window of the cab, looking forward down the track with the stump of a pipe clamped securely in his teeth. It was, Clark knew, the last few seconds of this man's life, and he felt an intense pain, not only over what was about to happen, but that he was a part of it. The train moved on to the trestle, and Clark saw Dodd push down on the generator handle. Back in the rearmost car, Smoke and Bobby Lee were engaged in conversation, and Smoke was telling his brother-in-law about Sally, Pearlie, Cal, and his ranch.
I'm glad you got a new family, Smoke. Sugarloaf sounds like a great place to live.
It's a great place to live. You have to come visit me there. Maybe stay for a while.
If I found a place like that, I'd be likely to stay for years, not just a while.
You are family, Bobby Lee. You're welcome as long as you...
The car came to an abrupt halt, and he and Bobby Lee, along with several other passengers in the car, were thrown from their seats. His attention fixated on the events unfolding before him. Clark watched as the engine plummeted downward, moving slowly as if time had been suspended. until it hit the ground below. The boiler exploded, and bits and pieces of the engine and the first two cars were blown high into the air, chunks of wreckage seeming to hang in place for a long moment before tumbling back down, many of them falling dangerously close to Clark and the others. The other cars were dragged down into the gully, the first two telescoping, with one car sliding into the other, the remaining cars buckling and braking before coming to a smashing rest.
Let's go! Let's get the money and get out of here!
The others started toward the wreckage, but Clark hung back.
Come on, Clark! That is, if you want your share of the money.
My God. What have we done?
But Clark had come too far and sunk too low to back out now. Clark joined the others as they hurried toward the wreckage. At the wreck site, Clark stumbled over something and, looking down, saw that it was a severed head. When he saw the pipe still clenched in the teeth, he realized it was the engineer's head.
Oh, my God.
Hurry up! Let's get the money and get out of here!
When they reached the express car, Clark saw that the messenger and all three of the guards from the Western Capital Security Agency were dead, but the safe was under the bulk of the overturned car. It was going to take all of them several minutes to pull the wreckage aside so they could reach the safe.
We're never going to get this out of here.
Get to work! Stop complaining and start moving the wreckage aside. We don't have all day.
Smoke and Bobby Lee managed to work their way out of the last car by pushing through a large rent in the side. At first, the scene that greeted them was unbelievable. Wreckage strewn about everywhere. Men, women, and children lying dead, dying, or badly injured. Bobby Lee pointed to some men who were standing in a pile of wreckage that was once the express car. They were working intensely, throwing aside pieces of timber in a desperate attempt to get to something underneath. Smoke thought they must be trying to rescue someone, and he started toward them, but Bobby Lee grabbed his arm.
Smoke! That's Dodd and his gang!
Dodd! Upon hearing his name called, Dodd, without hesitation, pulled his gun. And that was the opening shot of a deadly battle, with Smoke and Bobby Lee on one side and Dodd, Clark, and the others on the opposite side. For fully 30 seconds, the roar of the pistol fire overcame even the wails and cries of the wounded. Smoke and Bobby Lee stood side by side, exchanging fire with Dodd and the members of his gang. Gradually, the flashes grew fewer, and the exchange of gunfire slackened as one by one, the would-be train robbers fell in their tracks from well-placed .44 caliber balls. Smoke felt, rather than saw or heard, Bobby Lee go down beside him, and he responded by shooting and killing yet another of Dodd's gang. Finally, the last of Dodd's gang went down, and the shooting stopped. Smoke stood in place for a long moment afterward, holding a smoking pistol as the final echoes of gunfire rolled back from the nearby Excelsior Mountains. Smoke stood there, the only one doing so. It was as if someone had arranged a giant and very macabre tableau. Suddenly, and totally unexpectedly, Dodd sat up and pointed his pistol at Smoke. Smoke reacted quickly by pulling the trigger on his own pistol.
Well now, look at this. Ain't I the lucky one, though? Oh!
A black hole appeared in Dodd's forehead as he fell down. Thinking the shot must have come from Bobby Lee, Smoke looked down at his brother-in-law, but saw only open and opaque eyes looking up in their death stare. Bobby Lee was dead.
I owed you that, Mr. Jansen.
The voice came from one of the outlaws with whom Smoke had just done battle. Looking toward the sound, he saw that one of the other outlaws had managed to raise himself up onto his elbows. It wasn't until then that Smoke recognized him.
Clark? Emmett Clark?
Yeah, it's me.
You were riding with Dodd?
Yeah.
I don't understand. If you were riding with him, why did you shoot him?
Like I said, I owed it to you. Call it a matter of honor.
When Smoke returned to Sugarloaf, he learned that both Pearlie and Cal had won everything in their events at the rodeo. In addition, Pearlie had won Most Outstanding Cowboy, which came with a prize of a silver-studded saddle. Pearlie let it be known that he planned to give the saddle to Smoke. Smoke told Sally that he didn't feel right about taking the gift, but Sally convinced him that it was very important to Pearlie. So Smoke agreed. With great pomp and ceremony, Pearlie presented the saddle, and Smoke saw that Sally was right. There was genuine joy in Pearlie's face when Smoke accepted it. For the first several days after returning, Smoke was a bit pensive, thinking not only about the events of the previous few weeks, but also about the fact that Bobby Lee's death had severed the last living connection to Nicole. At first, he found the thought rather melancholy, but the more he contemplated it, the more he was able to find peace with the idea. The door to that part of his past was forever closed. Smoke had been back at Sugarloaf for 3 weeks when he received a letter that had no return address, but was postmarked from St. Louis, Missouri. Not until he opened it did he see that the letter was from the young woman he had met in Cloverdale.
Dear Mr. Jensen, I want to thank you very much for everything you did. You answered my telegram on behalf of Bobby Lee and, like a true friend, or as I later learned, a true brother, you came to help him. And while Bobby Lee was killed, he was at least spared the humiliation of being hanged for a crime he did not commit. I also want to thank you for giving me the reward money, though there aren't words enough to express the depth of my gratitude for that gesture. The money has enabled me to leave the life I had begun and start anew. To that end, I have returned to St. Louis, where I intend to, when the time is right, reestablish contact with my father, Thaddeus Culpepper. You may be surprised to learn, Mr. Jensen, that my father is a very wealthy man, so I feel guilty about having taken the reward money from you. I assure you, though, that the money was put to immediate and good purpose, and I promise that once I am reestablished, I will give every cent of the money you gave me to a worthy charity. Your friend, Minnie K. Culpepper.
Smoke, is everything all right?
Yes, everything's fine. It's from Minnie Smith, the girl I told you about.
The girl who worked at the Gold Strike Saloon? The girl you said was a very pretty girl?
Yes, that girl.
And now she's writing you letters?
Just one letter. So far.
Oh my. Should I be jealous?
Smoke got up from his chair, walked over to Sally, put his arms around her, and pulled her to him.
What do you think?
Smoke Jensen, the Mountain Man number 38, Shootout of the Mountain Man, is a graphic audio production. Copyright 2010, William W. Johnstone. Published by arrangement with Kensington Publishing Corporation. All rights reserved. Production copyright 2012, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Performed by Mort Shelby, James Lewis, Eric Messner, Richard Rowan, Patrick Busink, Tim Carlin, Elizabeth Jernigan, Thomas Penny, David Coyne, Michael John Casey, Christopher Sheeran, Ken Jackson, Johann Detweiler, Daniel Sontag, Stephen Carpenter, Terrence Aselford, James Konacek, Joe Brack, Nick DePinto, Kimberly Gilbert, Casey Platt, Nanette Savard, Drew Kopis, Michael Glenn, and Thomas Keegan. Directed by Johann Detweiler. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing, graphic audio sound design, and Smoke Jensen theme music by Johann Detweiler. Book adapted for graphic audio by Johann Detweiler. If you enjoyed Shootout of the Mountain Man, read the Pinnacle Edition. Visit www.kensingtonbooks.com. And be sure to look for William W. Johnstone's The First Mountain Man, The Last Mountain Man, Blood Bond, The Last Gunfighter, Eagles, and Sidewinder series, as well as Elmer Kelton's Texas Ranger series. All available in graphic audio at Road Stops Everywhere, at 1-800-670-5220, or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles as well as free downloads and podcasts. Now, keep listening for exciting previews of other titles in graphic audio. The warded man stalks the night, slaying demons with the newly discovered wards of power. But now, a new threat is rising. An old friend, now a bitter enemy. And he has in his possession a weapon that could unite all humanity, or tear it to pieces. The Desert Spear. Witness the rise of Amon Jardir in The Demon Cycle, Book 2, The Desert Spear. Available now in graphic audio.
Now we can invade the Green Lands.
In the cellars of the Wine God lies a key without a lock.
It's a puzzle box. In order to open it, you have to follow a certain sequence of motions.
And how do you know that you are on the right path?
You don't.
Ah, so the box mirrors life, no?
I suppose it does, but that doesn't help tell me how to get it open.
Doug Morrell's office.
Hi, Doug, it's Anya. I'm helping the French police with an investigation in the catacombs.
What? The catacombs? You're running an investigation in the catacombs and you didn't tell me? I'll send a crew over immediately.
There's nothing here of interest to the show. The authorities stumbled on the skeleton of a man in a Civil War uniform and...
Union or Confederate uniform?
Confederate, but that's really beside the point.
This is good, Anya. Real good. We can turn this into a world-class episode. Just leave it to me.
Doug, we're not doing an episode on this. I just need the letter authenticated.
Who's it from?
Jefferson Davis.
Confederate President Jefferson Davis?
The one and the same.
Anya?
Yes, Doug?
Let me be sure I've got this straight. You discovered a skeleton, dressed in the uniform of a Confederate soldier, carrying a letter from President Davis in the midst of the Paris catacombs, and you don't think there's anything of interest there for the show.
There you'll find the lady, left alone and in distress.
The Creed woman apparently survived the fall from the roof. She needs to be eliminated before she speaks to the police. Get back up there and get rid of her before she becomes more of a nuisance.
How did you get that?
I'd be happy to explain everything, but right now I think it's better if we got out of here, don't you? Run!
To find that which you are seeking, use the key to unlock the chest.
It would seem, Miss Creed, that you are better prepared to find the treasure than your colleague. I think it would be much better if you did the dirty work, found the treasure, and then just turned it over to me.
Like hell I will.
Kill one of them. I don't care which one.
Wait! Just wait a moment. I'm sure we can work this out.
Work this out? What is there to work out? You'll either find the treasure for me or I'll shoot your friends. It's pretty simple.
Fine. I'll do it.
See? That wasn't so difficult now, was it? What are you waiting for? I told you to kill one of them.
You son of a bitch!
Anya!
Ah.
Rogue Angel number 33, Cradle of Solitude.
Available now in graphic audio.
If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220. Or www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different graphic audio series, check out our convenient and easy-to-store long-haul box sets, which contain up to 5 books of a series. Available only at www.graphicaudio.net. Be sure to sign up for our monthly newsletter or follow us on Twitter.